Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and you want to bring those up for conversation, we can try to answer them for you or discuss them anyway. If you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to discuss that, feel free to give me a call as well. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. I have two announcements to make, and then we'll go right to the calls that we have waiting. One of them, I've been making this from time to time. I don't say this every day, but I do want to keep saying it as the time, you know, approaches, that there is a 12-day school that we're holding. Going to be teaching verse by verse in depth on the book of Acts. And this school is going to be held aboard a ship. In other words, it's on a cruise. Now, we don't charge anything for this school. In fact, I'm paying my own way on the school too. But you pay for a cruise, basically. It's a cruise to Alaska, from Los Angeles to Alaska. And so, we're going to have, you know, lectures every day, going through the book of Acts during the 12-day cruise. This is in September, September 17th through 29th. And, we'd be glad to have you join us if you're interested. Again, it'll cost you the cost of a normal cruise, but it won't cost you anything to be in our school. And we're doing it as a school. It's just that sometimes we hold these schools in, we've held these schools before in our home and have the students live there. A little difficult, feeding and housing 12 students in our home, or so. And we've even looked into renting motel rooms and things like that for these schools. I used to run a school where we owned a campus. We don't own a campus anymore. We sold the campus years ago. So, we don't have a campus. So when we want to run a short school, we have to find someplace to do it. And we found out that a ship, is actually not much more expensive than a hotel, room for students, and the meals being provided and so forth, and, you know, there's plenty for students to do when they're not in class. We just thought we'd try this. We've never had a cruise before, and I've never really wanted to go on a cruise before, but I'm looking at it as a school, but you could look at it as a school and a cruise if you're interested in joining us. It's in September. The cruise is from Los Angeles to Alaska and back, and it's September 17th through 29th. If you're interested in that, you can certainly sign up for it. We've got, you want to go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and look under announcements, and you'll find the information about that. Another thing you'll find information about there is this Saturday night in Temecula, we have our meeting that's about once every 2 months we do this. It's a Q&A meeting for anyone in the area who's interested in joining us at the Love of Christ Fellowship Church. And that's this Saturday at 6:30, and we'd love to have you there. Again, if you don't know where that is, you can go to thenarrowpath.com, look under announcements, and get all that information. While our lines are full, we want to get to them quickly. Let's talk to Alan from Connecticut. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Alan, thanks for calling.
It's always good to talk to you, Brother Steve.
Thank you.
Now, in my prologue to questions I've had in the past, I always say this is interesting to me. I hope it's interesting to others. To fulfill Philippians 2, verses 4, which says, look not only on your own things, but things of others. Now, the verse before is the one I have a question. It's always good, I think, that we consider each other equal, but it says esteem others better than ourselves. You know, I'm watching the television, and I'm looking at criminals who do things that are dastardly, and I have a hard time esteeming them better than myself. I actually feel disappointed. What does it mean to esteem others better than ourselves? Isn't it just as good just to think we're equal?
Well, of course,
chapter 2, verse 3.
Yeah. The context, of course, of Philippians is talking about relations within the church and how to treat each other. It's not talking about how you're supposed to view criminals and, you know, child molesters and things like that. There's no reason to believe that they are any better than you are. In fact, there's not really any reason to believe that most of the people in the church are any better than you are either. But when Paul says, esteem others better than, let each one esteem the other better than himself, this is the word better here, I don't think, is referring to a value judgment so much as a way that we treat someone. We treat somebody as if they're our superior, even if we know they're not. Just like Jesus did with his disciples when he washed their feet. He took the role of a slave, a servant, and treated them like they were above him. And he told them, you know, I want you to do the same to each other. So it's treating the other one as if they are your superior and you are the servant. That's what's in mind here. We have a similar kind of a command in Romans 12:10, where Paul said, be kindly affectionate one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. Now, again, in honor preferring one another to yourself is what he means. That is to say that, you know, be the servant and honor others as if in a sense that you prefer them and their interests above your own. Now, that's, I think, also what he's talking about in Philippians. It's just being a matter of being Christ-like. Christ wanted us to wash each other's feet, not necessarily literally, although some Christians take that literally. But it wants us to play the role of a servant to the other person as if they are better than we are. Now, it doesn't mean I have to genuinely convince myself that this person is better than I am, because how could Jesus convince himself that the disciples were better than he? In fact, he said to them after he washed their feet, you say I'm master and Lord, and you're right, I am. But if I, your master and Lord, have washed your feet, then you should wash each other's feet. So he's saying, I'm under no illusions that I'm not your master and Lord. I'm under no illusions that you're better than I am. But I'm treating you as if you're better than I am. And that's basically what he wants us to do. And I'm sure that's what Paul has in mind. He's not saying that you have to somehow convince yourself that everybody around you is truly a better person than you are. Some of them may be, and some certainly would not be. But that's not the point. I think he's talking about how to treat each other. I know he said esteem, which sounds like the way you think about somebody. But, you know, it does have to do with the way you think. You have to think, well, this person, you know, would be blessed if I treat them as if they're my superior. And the whole purpose of loving your neighbor is that you'd bless them, that you'd be a blessing to them. So that's how I understand Paul's intention there. And like I said, it sounds an awful lot like what he said in Romans 12:10.
Okay, thanks for the insight, Steve. Thank you. Bye then.
Okay, Alan, thanks for your call. Good talking to you. All right, our next caller is Rebecca from Washington, D.C. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good to talk to you. Mm-hmm. So today I have a question that's more about, like, practical living as opposed to, like, doctrine.
Okay.
So I want to make sure, obviously, that my life is clearly set apart from the world, and it's clear to the people I interact with that I'm serving Jesus and try to encourage people to become Christians too. But mm-hmm. I also don't want to appear like holier than thou or Pharisaical, because I know the Bible is pretty clear that you shouldn't like do good works in front of people. You should do them in private. But then how do you like balance that with, you know, being openly Christian too? So do you have any advice for striking that balance?
Well, it's interesting that Jesus in the same sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, said in the beginning of chapter 6 that you don't do your righteous deeds to be seen by men, or else you already have your reward. And he talked about praying and giving alms, and he talked about fasting. You shouldn't be like the hypocrites who do these things simply to be seen by men. So you're not supposed to be ostentatious in your religiosity. On the other hand, in the same sermon, just in chapter 5, he said, let your light shine before men so they'll see your good works and glorify your Father, which is in heaven. Now, your good works here are not a reference necessarily to your brownie point type good works, like you're getting a merit badge for it, like helping the poor or praying or fasting or whatever. This is talking about your good life in general, that you are living a different kind of life in general. Now, what the things you do specially that set you apart from the world in terms of your religious convictions and so forth, those can be very privately done. You don't have to hide them, but the main thing that Jesus said is don't do it to be seen by men. You're doing it for other reasons than that. If men see you or know that you do it, that's not a problem, but you're not doing it to impress them. Now, when Jesus said, let your light shine, that men will see your good works and glorify your Father, this also would be something that you're not necessarily trying to get attention to yourself, but you can't help it. You live differently than other people do. You can't hide the fact. If people are inviting you to participate in things that you can't do as a Christian, and you have to say, I'm sorry, I have to decline. You know, that's, they may think you're being holier than thou. By the way, the expression holier than thou is found in the Old Testament in Isaiah, and it describes the religious hypocrites who said, you know, stay away from me, I'm holier than thou, in the King James it says. And so it's obviously an attitude that somebody had about himself. I'm holier than somebody else. Now, usually, you know, we don't think we are holier than thou. Maybe some religious people do, but I mean, you don't, perhaps, and I don't. I don't think I'm holier than somebody else, but they may accuse you of being holier than thou simply because you won't participate with them in things. And this becomes an occasion of persecution. You're not told that you have to avoid having people mistakenly say that you've got a holier-than-thou attitude. The main thing is that you don't, that you realize that there but for the grace of God go I. I'm not better than these people, but I, you know, I'm on a different path. I'm seeking different goals than they are. And it's not that, you know, I mean, obviously I think the goals I'm seeking are better goals. That doesn't make me a better person. It just makes those better goals. I'm looking for what's best. I would suggest that 1 Peter 4, verses 1 through 4, would be relevant to your question. He says, well, especially verse 3 and 4. He says, for the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lasciviousness and lusts and excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries, in which they think it strange that you do not run with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. And you know, Peter says, you know, your old friends, they're going to think it strange that you're not doing those things with them, and they may speak evil of you. They may say you're holier than thou or whatever. The main thing is that you have to avoid feeling holier than thou, because you realize that you're a Christian not because of your own merit, but because of Christ's merit, because Christ is worth serving. It's not because you deserve more than these other people do. Now, you might say, but I made a better choice than they made. Well, that's true. And it is true that you, in fact, you may be a better person than them. Some people are better than others, no question about that. The Bible makes it very clear. Some people are worse than others. But the truth is that if you're better than others in any particular measure, it still is the case that you can't very well take credit for that. I mean, let's face it, you were raised in a godly home. They might not have been. If you meet other people who were raised in Christian homes and they themselves have gone bad, it may be that the home they were in was not as good an example, or it wasn't as stable or whatever as yours. You never know how much your own right choices are influenced by benefits you've had that you had nothing to say about. You just have to say, well, it's by the grace of God that I have the advantage. If I have an advantage in terms of recognizing the truth where other people don't, well, I can't really be sure that that's anything I've done. I mean, obviously, there had to be somebody who told me the truth. There had to be some conditioning in my upbringing that made me amenable to listen. I mean, there are, in other words, other parties, or ultimately God, who used other parties to help bring you to faith and to help open your eyes and to see things that others don't see. So if you're living a holier life than somebody is, that doesn't mean that you credit yourself as being holier than thou. If they call you that, that's usually just one of the insults they would like to use. And Peter said they're likely to use some of those.
Okay, thank you. That was really helpful.
Okay, Rebecca. God bless you. Thanks for your call. All right. Let's see here. Jennifer from New York. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
So my question is, what is the verse, why do the heathen rage and imagine a vain thing? What is the meaning of this verse in context and out of context?
Okay. Well, it's Psalm 2:1, and it's a psalm about the Messiah. Now, I don't know that all the Jews recognized, I think they did recognize it as a psalm about the Messiah, but whether they did or not, the New Testament writers quote it as a psalm about the Messiah. It actually says that the heathen, which is the non-Jews, heathen are Gentiles, and the people are the Jews. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? It means, why are there Gentiles and Jews who are involved in a vain project? And what is it they say, let us, throw off the chains of the Lord and of his anointed one. Now, basically, they're saying we don't want to serve God and we don't want to serve his anointed one. It's in verse 2, the kings of the earth set themselves, the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break off their bands and cast away their chains from us. Now, this is referring to the fact that on a certain occasion, and the apostles actually quoted this to identify that occasion, that there would be Gentiles and Jewish leaders together seeking to overthrow God's anointed one. Now, the word anointed one is the word Messiah. The word Messiah means anointed one, or in the Greek, it's the Christ. Christos is the anointed one. And so we have, therefore, a prediction here. Now, David, of course, talks as if it's happening in his own time, and very possibly it was, because David was also an anointed one, and he had people who tried to overthrow him, too. But David is a type or a foreshadowing of Christ in Scripture. And so even if it was true of David, it was recognized by the New Testament writers as really relevant to Christ himself. And so we find the apostles praying in, I'm actually looking for it now, it's in Acts chapter, it's either Acts chapter, let's see here, 4 or 5. It's chapter 4. In verse 24, it says, when the apostles heard that, they lifted up their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, thou art God who has made heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. You, by the mouth of your servant David, have said, why did the heathen rage, and the people imagine vain things? Then, as it continues, quoting, the kings of the earth stood up, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. Notice the anointed is represented as Christ here when the apostles quote it. For of a truth, now they're giving their interpretation of it, for of a truth, against your holy child Jesus, whom you have anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together, etc., etc. It talks about how they crucified Christ. He mentions Gentiles, the heathen, Herod, Pontius Pilate, the Gentiles, and also the leaders of Israel. So he says this is what was predicted in Psalm 2, that these people would rise up against your anointed, against the Christ. And they're saying that's surely what happened. They recognize it as having been fulfilled in the crucifixion of Christ. So that's what it was about. Now, in David's mind, when he wrote it, he may or may not have had all of that in mind. David may have been simply bemoaning the fact that he, as God's anointed king over Israel at the time, was being opposed futilely, that is, without success, by Gentiles and Jews who wanted to overthrow him. But God was going to keep him on the throne. But as I said, David in the Old Testament is a type and a shadow of Christ. So if David was only thinking of himself in this, and he might have been, the Holy Spirit speaking through him was actually speaking of something beyond David himself. And, of course, the apostles recognized it was speaking about Jesus.
Okay. Now, what vain thing, though, are they imagining towards?
The vain thing, okay, you know what vain means. Vain means something that, is going to be fruitless, something that's not going to be successful. It's something that will accomplish nothing. They are seeking to overthrow Christ. They're seeking to overthrow, God's appointment of Christ to be the ruler. And in the psalm goes on, God laughs at them and says, yet I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. In other words, in spite of your efforts to overthrow him, you have, in fact, failed. It was a vain effort you made because you're working against God. And he only laughs at people who try to do that. And he set up his king anyway. Now, what they're referring to there, the apostles see that as the resurrection of Christ. The Jews and Gentiles who crucified Christ were hoping to be rid of him. Well, it didn't quite work out for them. It was a vain thing because he's risen from the dead. And he was more of a nuisance to them than ever after that. So that's why it was a vain thing they were thinking about.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Jennifer, for your call. God bless
Bye.
You. Bye now. Okay, Jeffrey from Monterey Park, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Steve.
Uh-huh.
hoping I can formulate this question properly. And maybe you can direct me to any maybe topical teachings that you may have on the subject. But I'm interested in hearing your perspective about rewards. I've been reading some passages. I don't know them I do not know them by memory, but where Jesus is talking about when he comes in judgment, he will judge us by our works.
Mm-hmm.
And also how there will be rewards, and there seems that there will be some appointments. And right. I'm just trying to get an understanding of that. I don't know if it's because of our status now, you know, we're sinful in nature, but, you know, when everything is consumed or the consummation of things, that things will be different. Can you help me to try and have a proper perspective on that biblically? And
well, as far as
I'll take my answer off the air, yes.
Okay. Well, thanks. Thank you, Jeffrey. Well, as far as any lectures I might have on it, I don't know that I have any topical lectures on that subject, but you would find my verse-by-verse lectures on the relevant passages probably would address this. What kind of rewards are there, and how much a role should they play in our motivation to serve God? The Bible does tell us that this life is not the only life there is, and that when Jesus comes back, he will reward everyone according to his works. Paul said in 2 Corinthians that everyone will receive the things done in their body. And that would mean that the things you've done in this bodily life before you died or before Jesus came back would be things that, deserve some kind of response from God. Now, a reward can be a negative thing, too. You can reward a criminal with punishment. Usually we think of it in a positive sense, but when it says he'll reward everyone according to their works, it doesn't only mean he's going to give the good things to the people who've done well. He's going to reward every human being according to their just deserts, and therefore he's going to punish the wicked and give proper rewards to the righteous. Now, there are differences in rewards among the righteous, and you've read some of the passages apparently about that. We find it in the parable of the pounds. In Luke 19, we find it in the parable of the talents in Matthew 25. We find it, as I said, in 2 Corinthians and many other places. Actually, Romans chapter 2, verses 5 through 10 discusses that. And so do many other places make an allusion to it. Now, what are these rewards? Well, I'm not sure we know what these rewards are, and I'm not sure that we could even appreciate them if we did know, because we're talking about a time when we no longer have this present earthly fallen existence, and we are glorified and we're like Christ and living in a perfect environment and so forth. It's hard to know what kind of things will be valuable to us at that time. The rewards that might be offered, if we heard them today, we might say, well, I don't know, that doesn't sound very interesting. I mean, a lot of people think heaven's a place where we sit around on clouds and play harps. Well, that doesn't sound very fun. I wonder what's going on downstairs. Check it out. Maybe they have more fun down there. But the Bible only talks really symbolically about our life after this one, because there's no way that we can fully relate to the different order of existence that we will have at that time. If when I was a child, someone was trying to motivate me to do something by offering a reward, they'd probably offer me candy or some, or toys or, a trip to, Disneyland or something like that, which are things that I wouldn't be particularly motivated by today because I'm an adult now. When I was a child, I thought as a child, but as a man, I put away childish things. If, I might be motivated more today by someone giving me a good book or something like that, which a child wouldn't have any interest in at all. In other words, we are kind of in our childhood mode right now. We're going to be different when Jesus comes back. We will pass into another realm of existence. And who can say what we will appreciate then? If he told us what we will have, we might, in our childishness at this present time, say, I don't know. I don't know why I'd like that. I would much rather want something else, which is related to my childish, immature, carnal state that I'm in now. So I can't tell you what the rewards are. But you did make a correct observation. Sounds like there are assignments. And it may be that these are what the rewards are. Basically, God giving responsibility. He said to one servant, you've been faithful in a little, I'll make you a ruler over 5 cities. And to another one, you've been faithful, I'm going to make you rule over 10 cities. That is, there's different assignments of responsibility in the new earth, apparently. And it may be that the greatest reward, and certainly the one I would want most, is simply that God would be pleased with me. And I think that the more you do righteous, the more pleased he is about that. I mean, he is pleased by righteous behavior and displeased by unrighteous behavior. The Bible is very clear about that. So I would say that one of the rewards, maybe the main one, is that if we do righteously, God will be pleased with us more and having his pleasure, even if there's no trinkets attached to that, if there's no, other benefits than just that he's pleased. That may be reward enough. I have no idea. But I don't really serve him with these rewards in mind that much. I mean, some people maybe do, but I think the more we're thinking more just of doing the will of God because he deserves us to serve him, probably the better Christians we're going to become. And then we can be surprised by rewards, whatever they may be. We're going to take a break here just for about 30 seconds and come back for another 30 minutes, so don't go away. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and find everything free, or you can donate if you want, at thenarrowpath.com. Please stay tuned for 30 seconds. We'll be right back.
Small is the gate, and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. Right now our lines are full, but in a few minutes we may have a line opening up. If you want to take this number and use it at that time, you can get through. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or you have a different viewpoint you want to express, feel free to do that. The number to call is 844-484-5737. All right. As I said, our lines are full, so we'll talk to these callers right away. David in Los Angeles, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I hope you can hear me okay. I'm driving, and I'm hands-free, so...
Okay, so far we can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Five. Real quick. I think it was a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks ago, I heard you say that you did not believe that the United States was in Bible prophecy.
Right.
And I wanted to bring up a passage or two that maybe might lean towards the United States being in Bible prophecy.
Okay.
And those would be, it would be all of Revelation 13, 11 to 18. But specifically, verse 11, and I behold another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and spake as a dragon. If we know that the first beast came up out of the sea, and the sea represents multitudes of peoples and nations, as Revelation 17:15 tells us, the earth would then appear to be a uninhabited or sparsely habited part of the earth, which the United States did spring up out of a sparsely populated part of the earth. And the other part is being as it spake like a dragon. And how does a dragon speak? How does a nation speak? Well, a nation speaks through its legislature, its rules and laws that it makes. And certainly you would find things like slavery and abortion, abominable things, and things of Satan And these are brought about by men and legislators.
But let me just say this. I think you could find that in every nation, though. I don't know there's a specific application to America that wouldn't apply to every nation. Actually,
but if you go on to verse 12, it says he exercises all the power of the first beast before him. And the first beast, according to most, if not all, of the Protestant reformers, the first beast is the papacy. And we know that the United States is very cozy and has been very cozy with the papacy for many, many years, starting with Ronald Reagan administration.
But just think how many nations in Europe have been much more cozy with the papacy than we have. I mean, there's papal states. There's Catholic countries.
What nation in Europe is more powerful than the United States?
But I don't remember there being necessarily a suggestion here that the beast is the most powerful nation ever. You know, I mean, certainly the United States seems to be. Let me just say this. My own take on Revelation is considerably different than yours, and there are many different views of Revelation, of course. So if you want to find the United States in Revelation, you're welcome to do so. I'm afraid you can't persuade me because I actually have a complete view of Revelation that includes a complete idea of what the first and second beast represent. But certainly, you're entitled to have your own view about that.
Does your view or does your teaching include the papacy like all the Protestant reformers taught? And believe.
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't really feel obligated to teach all the things that the reformers taught. I feel obligated to study the Bible.
They died in vain, is what you're saying.
Well, I didn't say that, but are you saying that you believe everything the reformers taught?
No, I don't believe.
Are you saying they died in vain?
Luther's opinion about Jews, for example.
You disagree with some of the things they taught, and I disagree. Okay, we're talking over each other. So we both disagree with some things the Reformers taught. I disagree with that particular interpretation. But then the Reformers didn't think the second beast was Revelation. Was America? Did they? Luther didn't
because they believed
that both beasts were the papacy. So you don't agree with them either by saying it's America. So we both disagree with them about some things, and people certainly have every right to disagree with other people. And you disagree with the reformers, I do too. So I don't think you can scold me for that. The point is that I have a different view.
Well, but then we also have to take in the prophecy of the 2300 days for the sanctuary to be cleansed. In the 1260 years or the 3.5-year, 7-year period between 538 AD and 1798 AD when the United States became a nation.
Well, let me ask you this, David. David, let me ask you this. Are you a Seventh-day Adventist?
Well, we talked before, Steve. Of course you know I'm a Seventh-day Adventist.
No, I don't remember you. I have a lot of callers, so I don't remember you. Okay, so you're Seventh-day
Adventist.
In other words, I just gave you several minutes to share a Seventh-day Adventist view, which is one I disagree with. And that's what I say I'll do. If you call to disagree, I let you do it. I'm going to let some other people call now, but thank you for sharing the view. And you're always welcome to hold it and even share it. Lou from Los Angeles, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. I'd like to ask a question. Now, I have a Revised Standard Version, and I also have some other versions, and I have two questions. But the first one is, in Isaiah chapter 7:14, where it predicts, I think, the birth of Christ, in the Revised Standard Version, it says, a young woman shall bear a child. And shouldn't that be a virgin? Why don't they have virgin in there?
Well, the word...
And the other question was, why is it that you don't care for the... Amplified version of the Bible, because I thought it was pretty good, but I'd like to get your opinion.
Okay. Well, let me go for the latter question first. I'm not wild with the Amplified version for a couple of reasons. One, it's extremely burdensome to read because the author, the translator, decided to use every conceivable English word and every conceivable English nuance of each of the Greek words that they wanted to give, which means that for a single Greek word, you might be reading five words in English, and that takes an awful long time. And not all of those five words, although all five of those words might be one of the nuances of the Greek, not all five of them would apply necessarily to the passage in question. But there's another thing, and that is that the Amplified Bible places in brackets, in many places, the translator's own commentary, which happens to be dispensational, and I'm not dispensationalist, but I don't want to have a translation of the Bible where right within the verses of the Bible, in brackets, they put their own commentary, which is their own interpretation of something. So, you know, that's why I don't like it. I mean, I'm not saying other people can't like it, but I don't like it. It's not a Bible I would use. I might look at it on a certain passage to see, you know, how they render something, because I do look at different versions from time to time to see how different translators have rendered something. But I don't look at the Amplified Bible very often because I think it's got a theological agenda, and I really don't like a Bible that sticks the translator's interpretations in. Although they do it in brackets, somebody who doesn't know the difference would just think that that's one of the meanings of the words. Now, let's see, the reason I took that first is because I thought I'd forget it, but now I forgot your first one. Oh, Isaiah 14. The young woman. Okay. So yes. That's Isaiah 7:14 says in the Hebrew, the word for virgin or young woman is Alma. Alma is a Hebrew word that means a young woman. Now, young women in the Bible times were usually virgins, unless they were very, very immoral. Most girls lived at their father's homes until they were married at age 13 or 14. So a young woman was usually a virgin unless she was married. And yet some young women are married. But there's no known case in the Hebrew where the word Alma is used of a married young woman. So the King James and others have thought it should be translated a virgin. Now, in the Jewish translators who translated the Hebrew into Greek about three centuries before Christ, that is the Septuagint translators, they translated that word Alma into the Greek word Parthenos, which means a virgin. In other words, the Jews three centuries before Christ believed that the word would best be rendered as a virgin, because Parthenos in the Greek does mean a virgin. Alma means a young woman or young girl, usually referring to a virgin, but somewhat less clear, because, I mean, a young woman who's not a virgin could still be an Alma. But a Parthenos in the Greek is always a virgin, and therefore the Hebrew scholars who translated it into Greek long before Jesus was born translated it to say a Parthenos, a virgin, the virgin shall conceive. So this is why the New Testament writers, including Matthew, who quoted it, rendered it also as a virgin and applied it to the virgin birth of Christ. So the Hebrew word can mean a young woman, and yet it can also mean, and usually meant, a young woman who happens to be a virgin. But the Jewish scholars three centuries before Christ, translating it into Greek, chose a word that always means a virgin. So there's not really any reason to object to Christians calling it a virgin, since the Jewish translators themselves translated it that way. All right. Did we lose him? I guess. Maybe he's not there. I don't see him anymore. He must have hung up. All right. Hopefully we got that across. Let's talk to Rob from Vancouver, B.C. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
Just for the record, we're really glad to have you up here in Vancouver. I love listening to you. I've been listening to you now for about a month. And, really great to have you. It's just been super helpful. So I've recently accepted the Lord as my Savior, and I was baptized on Mother's Day. And one of the pastors from my church couldn't be there, so I sent him an email after saying, I wish you could have been there. He sent me a response saying, I love you and good for you. And at the end, he said, be careful, because just like Jesus, you're going to be tempted now by the devil. After he was baptized, he was tempted. And I just was hoping you could touch a little bit. There was a couple things I wanted to ask you about the baptism, but why does that upset Satan so much that we get baptized? Is he mad that he's lost us? And then why would he go to the extent of trying to tempt Christ after he was baptized?
Yeah. Well, in terms of a Christian's baptism, we have to understand that in biblical times, a person was baptized the same day they were converted. Now, that doesn't always happen for us. Sometimes churches, after you get converted, they schedule a time for you to be baptized at a later date. This was never practiced in the New Testament times. When a person was converted, they took him to the water right away because that was considered making their oath of loyalty to Christ. It's a little bit like, you know, at a wedding, they put the ring on the finger there at the ceremony. You could still be married without the ring, but you wouldn't be, you know, advertising to the world that you were married until you put on the ring. Now, generally speaking, when you make the vows and you're married, that's when you put on the ring, and that was never, as far as we know, never an exception in the early church. There are plenty of exceptions today. But for Satan to attack you after you've been baptized simply means he's attacking you now as a Christian, as opposed to before. Now, I think that before you're a Christian, you're no threat to him. You're no threat to the devil. You just kind of live in a selfish, sinful life just like he wants you to.
Yeah.
He hardly even has to involve himself to keep you in that role. But once you've decided to follow Christ, you are a real threat to him. And so he does seek to, you know, compromise you. He does seek to corrupt you and especially to try to dissuade you from following Christ, to try to persuade you to become an unbeliever again. And so being baptized, I would say the devil does that as soon as you become a believer, but in the Bible, becoming a believer and being baptized happen at the same time. It's just something that's practiced, I think, unfortunately, differently now. I think the church should follow the old way, but that's not always how it's done. So as far as tempting Christ, I believe the devil tempted Christ even before he was baptized. I mean,
I'm sorry. Okay, if I got that wrong.
Well, no,
okay.
No. We don't read of it. We read the temptation did occur. The three temptations we read about in the Gospels occurred after Jesus was baptized. What I'm saying is that Jesus was 30 years old at that time. And the Bible says he was tempted in all points like we are, yet without sin.
Oh, I see.
I suspect that through his teenage years and so forth, he had normal teenage temptations and so forth. But when he was baptized, he began his mission. And so the devil, you know, I guess he had to face testing right from the beginning of his mission to see if he's going to qualify for the mission. And so the Holy Spirit actually led him into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. This was God's plan for Jesus.
That's the 40 days in the wilderness? That's when that was?
Yeah, that's when that was, yeah.
I see.
Those were not the only times that Jesus experienced temptation in his life. Those are simply three remarkable temptations that occurred at that particular time at the beginning of his ministry. But I'm sure he was tempted, you know, in the earlier years of his life, just like everybody is, and later too.
Right.
We don't have a record of every day of Jesus' life. Only a few days of his life are recorded.
And why do other denominations not put such a? Because from what I understand, it's very important to be baptized, when I hear the Catholics just sort of dab their forehead with water, and I don't even know if Jehovah's Witnesses get baptized or Mormons, or is it not sort of really important? If Jesus did it, shouldn't everybody do it?
Yeah, and I'm sure that both Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses do get baptized. I know the Mormons do. They consider baptism one of the four things you have to do to be saved. All churches believe in baptism, as far as I know. I don't know of any churches that don't. But some of them take a very strong and strict attitude toward it. For example, the Church of Christ is a group that, you know, they don't consider you that you're saved until you're, you know, baptized in water.
Whereas
Baptists, generally speaking, are quite content to have you get saved, come forward at an altar call on a Sunday morning and maybe be baptized a few weeks later in a Sunday evening service or something. You know, some churches are more lackluster about it than others. And some don't even seem to push baptism at all. Well, I would say they believe in baptism. They just don't really make it they don't make it a priority at all.
Do you believe that? Do you believe that it's really important though?
I believe it's mandated. I believe it's mandatory. Yeah, I believe that.
That's what I thought. That's the way I took it.
Right. But see, let me put it this way. I believe it's mandated, as many other things are mandated in the Christian life, but Christians sometimes fall short of fulfilling.
Yes, sir. Yes,
yes. So, yeah. So if a person has, let's just say they haven't been baptized, but they've given their life to Christ.
Right.
And they're not really aware that it's very important to be baptized. So their neglect of it does not reflect any kind of, you know, unwillingness to obey Christ or anything like that.
I
could believe they're saved, but they should be informed that baptism is commanded and it's not optional, you know.
That's fantastic. Sir, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, Rob, thanks for your call. God bless you. All right, let's talk to D.W. from Pontiac, Michigan. Hi, D.W. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Nice to talk to you. I have a question about, well, first of all, I'd like to say how much I appreciate your program. It's a great program. I love your ministry, and I would encourage anybody listening that likes the program to go to the website and donate. I donate quite often because I don't want to lose the program. And I appreciate you. And
that is a realistic fear for some of these stations. Yeah,
for sure. Okay, so here's the question. You know, I want to know what your take is on shows about Christ and Christ's life and stuff that are on some of these secular networks like the History Channel or something like that. You know, I like to watch programs about Christ, but it seems like every time I watch one on one of those stations, they always end up slipping in stuff that seems to be, to me, like maybe it's not them, but the devil, like purposely put in there to try to cause doubt, you know. And there was one in particular that played on the History Channel around Easter, and it was about the life of Christ, and it was something new that hadn't been on. It was like 5 or 6 episodes. And anyway, I was watching it, and then they made a real point towards the end where they were where Christ was in front of Pontius Pilate and all that, and they said that where the gospel writers wrote that Pilate was indecisive and not sure and tried to put it off on Herod and this, that, they said that surely was not true, that the apostles just put that in there because they were trying to convert people in Rome, and that would make it easier to make it look like it was the Jews that you know, had the heavy hand.
Well, let me jump in before we run out of time here. I understand your concern, and I have the same concern. In fact, anytime you watch a biblical, documentary, or a Christian documentary or something about Christ that's made by secular people, just know that it's not going to be reliable, because if they really believed what we believe, they'd be Christians. The fact that they're not Christians means that they don't accept this. And they usually, if they take the time to make a story from the story of Jesus or Samson or David or any of those people, they're doing it for Hollywood purposes. I mean, lately, just in the past 5 years, you know, there was the movie about Noah with Russell Crowe, which was is an abominable movie. It's absolutely, totally unscriptural. And then later, shortly after, I think Christian Bale was in a movie about Moses and the Exodus, which is also I consider to be lousy. You know, I mean, there are people who respect Christ and respect the Bible and make biblical movies. I even have some problems with many of them, not with their motivation, but with the outcome. It's a pretty serious thing for an actor to try to represent Jesus for millions of viewers. You know, I mean, Jesus is unique, and I'm sure that the actors who played him in many cases have been very sincere and very eager to, you know, to portray him well and to glorify him. But I don't know. It's awfully hard to imagine how a human being could faithfully represent Jesus as he was. And if you don't do it as he was, you're nonetheless putting images in your viewer's mind of what you think he was like. And those may not ever get out.
Do you avoid those types of programs?
You know, I can't say I avoid them out of conviction. I've seen many of the Jesus movies when they come out. I try to watch them, but I have not liked a lot of them. I really liked the one on the Gospel of John. I forget the actor's name. He's an Australian, I think. He was one of the actors in Lost, and he's a Roman Catholic, I believe, at least nominally. But I thought he did a great job portraying Jesus compared to most. It's called the Gospel of John. Most of them, I think the actors do as good a job as they can, and they probably really love the Lord and really try to do a good job. But I don't know. In many respects, they picture Jesus differently than I do, and they portray him differently than I think he is, and that makes it hard. You know, I'm not going to criticize the whole genre of biblical movies. I mean, let's face it, some of them I think were really bad. Some of them are better than others. And I know that there's the Jesus film that has won many people to Christ around the world. So, you know, I'm not going to broad brush the whole genre. I'll just say that I don't watch many of them anymore because I'm so disappointed with a great number of them. And
I was going to make a comment about
the comment about Pontius Pilate. When somebody says, well, obviously, though the Bible says that happened, that obviously didn't happen. I'm going to ask, how do you know it didn't happen? The accounts from the four Gospels all record that Pontius Pilate found Jesus not guilty. These are four independent witnesses. They're so independent, in fact, that people sometimes accuse them of contradicting each other significantly. They obviously aren't copying each other. They're not colluding. And that we have four separate witnesses that Pontius Pilate, found Jesus innocent when he's brought before him. Now, how many witnesses are there that he didn't? Zero. Okay. Yeah. So it's to say, but we know about Pontius Pilate. He was a raunchy guy, and he wouldn't be so nice to Jesus. Well, we don't know.
That's what they said, that he was, you know, that was absolutely the
I know, and you know what? The Gospels.
Way he would typically react.
Right, and the Gospels were aware of how Pontius Pilate typically reacted. Remember, Luke 13 tells us that Pontius Pilate slaughtered a bunch of Jews when they were offering their sacrifices in the temple. That's certainly, the Gospel writers are very much aware of the cruelty of Pontius Pilate. But they also are aware that Pontius Pilate was moved by his encounter with Jesus. He was also moved by the fact that his wife sent him a letter and said, don't have anything to do with this man because I've suffered many things in a dream. That apparently impacted him. And Pontius Pilate did not like the Jews. And they figured, these Jews don't like Jesus. So, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I think that Pontius Pilate acted very uncharacteristically in his dealing with Jesus. I think there's a lot of reasons that he did. One of which was, I think he was very impressed with Jesus. But I think he knew that Jesus was no threat to the Romans. He knew that the Jews, the Bible says he knew that the Jews brought him because of jealousy of him. So, you know, he liked to put it to the Jews sometimes. So he, you know, by saying, I think Jesus is innocent. I think he's okay. You know, that Pontius Pilate could have had influences on that occasion that made him behave that way is not unlikely. And there are four witnesses that say he did act that way. So how many witnesses are there that say he didn't? Zero. So, you know, if you've got two theories, one, Pilate acted that way on that occasion. The other theory is he didn't. Okay, well, I'll go with the theory that has four witnesses and he did, and not with the theory that doesn't have any witnesses saying that he didn't. All right, so I appreciate your call. I'm out of time. My apologies to the rest of you who are waiting online. Fortunately, it's early in the week. I hope you can call back tomorrow and we can take some of those calls that didn't get on today. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're on Monday through Friday doing this same format, taking your questions and seeking to answer if we can. This is a listener-supported ministry. We have no advertisements. We have no products for sale. And we don't let anyone else sell their products here. But we simply let you know, if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.